Self-Evident is a podcast that is dedicated to speaking truths that were once self-evident and doing so in love. Hello again, you guys. It's Jenna. In this edition of Self-Evident, Brenda and I conclude our conversation with Maya Poet, a former Israeli civilian. Now, in part one of our conversation with Maya, she had related the politics of the countries surrounding Israel, the pan-Arab states, and how Palestinians are forced to remain second-class citizens at the hands of these governments. You can listen to that episode by following the link in the description. For this episode, Maya shares the side of the Israeli citizens during the Gaza-Israeli war and her personal experience of the horrors of living through October 7th, 2023 in that ambush-rocked country. Be warned, this is not a light listen. So we've heard about the side of the Palestinians and their struggles about trying to get out. But what about the other side? When Ali Beth Stuckey recently released her book of Toxic Empathy, her goal was to show that the left always presents with an empathetic argument. We hear a lot in the mainstream media about what's happening with the Palestinian refugees. What's going on in Israel? Can you give us any insights about how is this affecting Israeli citizens?
Oh, yeah. If you lived in areas that Hamas attacked, like in the kibbutzes in the Gaza envelope, and obviously your houses were destroyed, you're now internally displaced. So, and also the Israeli citizens and civilians who are on the border with Lebanon, because now there's, well, for the last, you know, God knows how many months, the Hezbollah group, which is another Iranian proxy. And also it's a political party in Lebanon, and Lebanon's political system. We could do a whole episode just on that, like the way that Lebanon's political system is structured, but it's basically a failed state. And like Lebanon doesn't have its own military anymore. Like the Lebanese soldiers, like their moms have to like help sew up their uniforms and pack their wow. little lunches, because it's a failed state because of all the embezzlement of these different corrupt, you know, politicians. Goes and Hezbollah is basically, it's not Lebanon's, de jure military, but it's Lebanon's de facto military, and it's an operative of Iran. So it actually doesn't Crazy. Care about the citizens of Lebanon. It just wants to, you know, fulfill Iran's goals.
And Iran's goals. We actually thought America yeah. had it bad.
Right. Oh, no. Like this is like little drops in the bucket. This is like small potatoes, like compared to the chaos of the Middle East. Like your military, imagine like your military operative being actually the military operative of a different country. So your civilians, it's your families that are put at risk because, you know, this is
they
not like
care.
A Lebanon. Yeah, they don't care. They just don't care. They only care about Iran's goals. They don't care about the people of Lebanon. Like, and if they were the Lebanese military, they would probably try to de-escalate, because there have been a couple wars now in Lebanon with Israel, and it doesn't go well for Lebanon. It just doesn't. And Lebanon already, like prior to this, has been a country in free fall for several years. I mean, following the explosion at the port of Beirut, which was a result of like total government negligence and the fact that, you know, Lebanon is not known to produce much of its own goods. I think it only produces like 10% of what it uses. It relied on imports, basically. You know, it doesn't export much and it just relies on imports. And they're having this like massive inflation. The Lebanese currency is like just totally depreciated so much that people are like really suffering. And that's just what happens when your government is in shambles and like following the Lebanese civil war, which is not one of the wars with Israel, but following the Lebanese civil war.
Yeah.
The government basically was restructured where you have to have like president has to belong to like one religion and like a prime minister has to belong to a different religion. So that, you know, it was a way to sort of maintain equilibrium and basically saying like, oh, everybody here, in the parliament has a say. But what ends up happening with that is that because it's not about actual issues and because it's about like sectarian, you know, like identity politics, these politicians know that they basically have a built-in group of supporters, because that built-in group of supporters is their like ethnic and religious constituency.
Yeah.
And so they don't actually have to win the trust of the people. It's a very different way of thinking about politics.
100%.
So yeah, Westerners definitely don't know about that, but like anyways, so there are these political proxies and they're ruining the lives of Lebanese. They're ruining the lives of Yemenis and with Houthi proxy in Yemen. First, I'm just going to answer the question you asked because I have this tendency to go on random tangents. But
it's like, great information. So we really appreciate the tangents.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. The question you asked was about the Israeli civilians. So whether you're on the border with Gaza or on the border with Lebanon, you were internally displaced. So, yeah. I mean, that's like tens of thousands of people already. I mean, that's like nuts. And they're basically living out of hotels, and they're like, sure, they're not living out of tents, because Israel is a country that actually cares about its citizens, which is the difference. You know, the reason that Palestinians are living in tents when they're refugees is not because the Jews are evil. It's because their leaders are evil. Their leaders actually don't care if they live or die. And a lot of the people of Gaza have bought into this. It's not as if it's not like Iran. Like in Iran, the populace hates their leadership. They hate the Islamic Republic of Iran. There are so many videos coming out of Iran, like when Israel like sends some kind of a bomb or like executes some kind of like Iranian leader, the people of Iran will literally light fireworks. You know, there will be pictures that the regime will post of like their supreme leader, and Iranians will just straight up burn them. They'll just take a lighter and they'll just burn those pictures. So the people of Iran actually really hate their leadership, but the people of Gaza don't seem to hate their leadership very much. They don't, because they don't really remember. They went from a tribal society into this highly militarized society where they were fed these religious lies and this, you know, idea of like everything. It's all about jihad. We can't live side by side with the Jews. We have to kill them. This is our religious duty. Iran wasn't like that. Iran was actually like a civilized country. If you look at pictures from Iran in like the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they're wearing what women in the West would have worn. And then in 79, there was this Islamic revolution. And so you have people who are like our parents' age who remember having a childhood where there was like some kind of relative freedom and prosperity. And then as they grow into adolescence, parents really remember what life was like before the society got captured by Islam.
Yeah, so, Annie Cyrus, her story is actually her grandmother remembered that from before when Iran was freer. And that was the only reason that Annie survived that entire thing, was her grandmother remembered there is freedom and my granddaughter should have rights. And so she was able to smuggle her granddaughter out of Iran.
Yeah, no, precisely. Yeah, you need to have a frame of reference for what's a good way to live and what's not. And and I guess Israel tried to combat this by giving like, how many was it? Like 50,000 or so? I don't know. Don't quote me on that. But okay. It was like some crazy amount of work permits. It was like, you know, it was in the tens of thousands of work permits they'd started to give out to Palestinians of Gaza. Because if you want to make a life in Gaza, if you want to make money, you're basically stuck being a Hamas operative. Because Hamas, wow, with all the money that they get, all the international aid money, where does it go? Where is the investment? It's not as if they're not investing it anywhere. They're investing it into war. They're investing it into tunnel building. They're investing it into being a Hamas operative. They're investing it into paying terrorists and their families for murdering Jews. And that's not even just Hamas. That's the Palestinian authority. So they're definitely not a partner for peace, but they're just more secular. They kind of buy into the goals of jihad. They're like explicitly more secular. They're not like a religious type of operative. They're kind of secular.
It's more like
nationalists
for their own political gain, right, rather than a belief system or an ideology.
Right. Well, their ideology is basically just a somewhat secularized version of jihad. So it's just like, it's not like the Palestinians have really great options to choose from.
Not really.
But no, they're just kind of screwed, like no matter what they choose, which is why Palestinians who are really not into these ideas will get out. They just leave. And so what you have are the people who are like kind of less critical thinkers, who are more conformist. In general, you have most people conform. That's the idea. Like most people are persuaded by certain moral boundaries and laws. And then you have some people who are extremely non-conforming in pretty fundamental ways. And sometimes it's very good that you have extreme non-conformists. And sometimes those extreme non-conformists are like sociopaths and psychopaths. But most people conform. And in the West, you know, and this seems to be just how the bell curve of like kind of human behavior and human tribalism and in and out groups and human psychology tends to go, is that you have most people who are willing to abide by whatever the stated goals and laws are. Yeah. And then you have some people who really aren't. And they're the types of rebels that like, you know, make cool music and wear their hair in a bunch of odd ways. And they're kind of cultural and like medical, even revolutionaries. They're exceptional people. They're usually exceptionally intelligent. But then you have the other types of rebels who are like dangerous, who have no regard for human life. And the problem with what's happening in Gaza is that rules to which people conform, you know, the basic moral and social frameworks are based on violence within the family. based on hatred, teaching kids to kill Jews and teaching kids to throw stones or rocks at soldiers from a very young age. And if you don't conform, if you are a nonconformist, if you don't conform to these ways of being which are antithetical to human existence, like the culture of Gaza is basically like it is the culture of psychopathy, except it is not confined to the fringes. It is the normal. It is the normal kind of functioning. What ends up happening is that basically you have these kids who are radicalized from a very young age. And if they don't follow along, if they don't get with the program, and there are stories of this, Prager, you did an interview with a guy like that. I mean, his family basically taught him, you know, to hate Jews and to murder Jews. And that was the lesson at school. They would teach in school, like, this is the curriculum, you know, they'll teach kids math by saying, like, three Jews were killed on Monday and two Jews were killed on Tuesday. How many dead Jews are there? If you look into the textbooks that are provided by UNRWA, which is the UN's refugee agency that is devoted specifically to Palestinians. So, like, refugees around the world, they are basically, their cases are processed by the UNHCR. The United Nations, like Human Rights Council, whatever it is called, commission. And UNRWA is specifically the agency devoted to taking Palestinian cases. It has many times the budget of the UNHCR. So basically this one group of refugees in this one crisis, and those refugees also include the Palestinians who have lived in Lebanon so long that they should just be Lebanese or they should just be Syrian. But if you can keep the idea and the refugee mindset alive, then you can get a lot more funding. And so there is a vested interest, you know, when you look at the way that UNRWA, like the teachers that it provides, the way it trains its teachers, it literally trains its teachers to train the children to become jihadis. It's extremely corrupt.
There are just so many more strings attached than initially thought. You know, you see like this surface topic about, oh, Israel and Gaza are having a war, but then digging into it and listening about the state of the countries, and I'm using quotation marks around there, like around them, this is mind-boggling.
Brings it back to like education, and I mean even just like bringing it even back to like America, and like from that perspective of what are we teaching kids, and it kind of like
it really so does crazy. Demonstrate yeah. the power of academia as well. Like mm-hmm. you are literally raising up in the Middle East to become good little jihadists. And then here in America, what are we teaching? I 100% agree with that.
Yeah. So my question to you, and I know that you said that you've lived through multiple wars, but then you mentioned that the October 7th attacks was the worst one. How has your outlook on life changed since then?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think that I'll start with all Israelis. Israelis in general, I have friends who are like twice my age or around about there. I have a friend even who said, like, I literally had a terrorist like point a gun to my head, you know, 20 years ago when I was your age, and the gun didn't go off, and still October 7th was worse. It was just so traumatizing, like the notion that terrorists who are launching rockets at you, because Israelis are used to rockets. They're used to it. Like the kids obviously are terrified. Yeah, no, it's totally insane, but it's normal for them. Like you, like psychologically, you can't survive if you get scared every single time.
Yeah, you've desensitized yourself.
Yeah, you have to, otherwise you go insane. And so the parents are trying to kind of comfort their kids because their kids are obviously scared because kids are new to the world. And so it's scary and it's new for them. But this was a whole new level because there were now terrorists like rampaging through the country and busting down the doors to bomb shelters. Like I remember for myself, on October 7th, like I woke up at, you know, 8 a.m. to a siren. And at first I thought they were testing the weapon system. Like I thought either the siren, because they do that every now and again. And usually they'll warn you about that. So I thought, okay, surely it must be that. Because I was living in a city where you're not used to getting rockets during war. Like you might get a couple symbolic ones, but it's not like a major target. So I heard a siren and then I was looking up on the internet, first in English, then in Hebrew, like to try to figure out where can I figure out if they're just testing the siren? And by the time the webpage had loaded, I just heard like six explosions, one right after the next, which means that like six rockets had been launched at my direction and that they'd been intercepted by the Iron Dome. That's what the explosion is. And I thought, okay, surely like, because like after the previous wars, whenever I'd hear like loud explosions and I knew the war was over, I knew there was a ceasefire. If I'd hear a loud explosion, I'd like freak out and try to run for a bomb shelter, like it just automatically. At some point I got used to the fact that, oh, they're just doing construction. So I thought, what are the chances that they're testing the siren and just doing construction that, like, maybe some, like, I don't know what I was
pure,
just
pure
trying
coincidence.
To,
yeah.
Right. By pure, I was trying to convince myself that it wasn't real. And then we heard another siren, and then, like, and this is back when, you know, when I was living as a man. So I didn't, I had this whole charade to maintain. And so, I heard the siren and I was sweaty. I was nervous. And then I heard the next siren and I was like, oh no, this is for real. I didn't know where the bomb shelter was. I was in a new apartment complex. I didn't have time to put on my breast binder, like the thing that I was, the garment I was using to sort of squash my breasts so that I could pass myself off as a man, or at least as like a teenage boy. And I didn't have time to put that thing on. I just had to run for it because, like, it's really hard to squeeze yourself into that thing, especially if your body is wet. It's like a sports bra, but like a million times more tight because it's meant to actually squash your breasts, not to sort of support them. And so anyways, like, I just had to layer up a bunch of shirts and just, like, run for it. Like, I just had to, you know, in the back of my mind, I was still thinking, like, oh my God, like, what if people see that I have breasts? Like, everybody in this neighborhood knows me as a guy. But soon thereafter, sort of my priority, I got a sense of priorities because it stopped kind of mattering on October 7th, like how people perceived me. It just kind of mattered that, you know, staying alive, essentially. It was crazy because the Home Front Command told us, like, there are terrorists, like, running through the country. We were starting to get these images, like, through Telegram channels of just absolute gruesome and gore. And then I opened Facebook and I was like, surely Facebook is going to be censoring some of this, but it wasn't. Like, that's how I saw, like, a video of a person who I later figured out was one of my friends. Like, I saw his last moments on
I'm
that.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it was like, I don't even, like, it's nuts. And, like, I can't, like, and this is not a story that's, like, unique to me. This is the Israeli story. Like, it was different from other wars. Like, you just sort of, you know, it's one thing to have rockets launched at you. Like, I'd sort of gotten used to the rocket bit because I'd lived through a couple wars, and you know that, like, depending on, like, what city you're on, you have to go to a bomb shelter within, you know, 1 minute, 1 minute, 30 seconds, 2 minutes. If you're on the Gaza envelope, you have a few seconds to get to a bomb shelter. Wow. And so, like, you get used to that. But then there was this added element of, like, now your bomb shelters aren't even safe because we don't know how far the terrorists have gotten. Like, they've been busting down doors to bomb shelters. They've been, like, executing people in there. They've been burning people to death. They've been, like, they would throw grenades inside bomb shelter. Like, and nobody was telling us anything. Like, we just knew that there was this crazy thing going on around the Gaza border. Then we heard about the music festival. And then we heard about the fact that, like, the people who are in these highly affected areas were calling on the police and the IDF to come and take control of the situation. It was a holiday. And so there's this crazy, like, you don't know actually though what's going on. Like, nobody is telling you if terrorists have made it to your city and you have no way of knowing. And so, like, they would say, you can't go outside. And eventually I was just like, well, in order to go to the bomb shelter, I have to run outside because because the bomb shelter is in a different building. Like, we had a safe room in our building, but it was like one of those doors with, like, flimsy kind of plywood with, like, little, it was kind of like a bike closet. Like, it had these kind of blinds on it, you know? And so it wasn't like a terrorist could easily put his gun right through there and shoot everybody. Like, so, and we tried to jam the door with, like, a broom, and it didn't work because it was too narrow of a door, and it didn't work. And so I was like, okay, there is no good way out of this situation. Like, if a terrorist is, like, coming, there's actually no real way to keep us safe. Like, I felt totally totally unsafe. And whenever I wanted to go outside, like, at some point, you know, the Home Front Command was saying, don't go outside, lock your doors, stay inside. And at some point I was like, you know, it was siren after siren. And every time you hear the siren, like, you are just hoping that the Iron Dome doesn't malfunction. And you are hoping that even if it does intercept the rocket, that some heavy rocket debris won't fall on your building. And the siren is scary. But the siren, rationally, you know, the siren is keeping you safe, but irrationally it's terrifying. And then you hear the explosions, and if they get closer and closer and they shake the building, you're like, it's a totally mortifying experience. And there was some point when I was like, screw it. I need to take a walk outside. If I get killed by terrorists, like, actually, what's the big problem? Mm. Like, I was like,
at that point, you didn't care.
I just didn't care. I was just like, screw it. Like, I can't, like, if I get killed by terrorists, at least I'll be put out of my misery. And then because this level of anxiety, it's just impossible to cope with. It is just, and like, I was alone, like my family wasn't there or anything. So I was like, my family was back in the States. And so I was like, screw it. And so whenever I went outside just for like a nice little fresh air break, I thought that it would resolve my anxiety, because walks are great. Exercise and endorphins, it's great for resolving anxiety. But I think only to a point. Like, so I was walking down the street of the neighborhood, and whenever I heard a car, I would like duck down. I would just get like really small, duck down on the street and hide behind like rows of shrubs or parked cars on the street. Because you think it's like it's not like the United States where you have these wide streets. It's like very narrow streets and narrow walkways. I would just hide behind, you know, the way they do in military movies. Like if you have like a wall that like of some destroyed building, like you'll kind of hide behind there and maybe have a little hole to like peek through. So I just took inspiration from those military movies. And whenever I heard a car, I was like, I just ducked down, hid, and just kind of like turned my head up like this, like out of the corner of my eye, like
that
looked
is
up.
Insane.
Because there were terrorists who were hijacking vehicles.
Right.
And I'd seen videos of that by then. It had been a few hours into this. And so I was always like, whenever I heard a car, my heart would race and then it would stop. And then my body would just go cold. And I would just like, look like really, I just get so small, so small. And I would just look up and try to see out of the corner of my eye, if it was a van, if it was a car, if it looked like there were multiple people, like if it was a truck, if I could hear. At some point I became really attuned to hearing if it's a truck or if it's a car.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's like, and this is what
does amazing things to the senses of your body. That's insane.
So that's what it's like from a human perspective. Like for Israelis, it's like totally, and we're talking about like a group of people who is used to routine rocket attacks. And this was just way worse.
Yeah. As I'm listening to you explain like, oh yeah, this is rockets are just like a normal daily occurrence for Israelis. And the closest comparison I can possibly think of is in the Midwest here in Illinois, in Indiana, when tornado sirens would be tested. You know, it's just every week or so, and everybody knows that Tuesday at 10 a.m., that's when it's going to go off. And so everybody is calm when that happens. They're like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. And then when tornadoes actually do come through, Midwesterners are just like, oh yeah, let's go sit on our front porch and watch, because like this is just a normal occurrence, and let's see how far it gets away from our house, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But those are just natural phenomenon. That is not actually countries and organizations around you actively trying to pinpoint you and kill you.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
I genuinely have no words. I'm so grateful that you are able to talk about this, and thank you for sharing your story. And I'm really sorry that you had to go through that. And for our listeners, to hear more about Maya's story, we had her on the Self-Evident podcast back in June. You will find that her episode is episode 72 and episode 73. And we talk about what she experienced living as a man and then detransitioning, and what her life has been like after that. And then what her thoughts and perspectives are on the movement here in America to purport this agenda as much as academia and politics and social media possibly can. But Maya, any last thoughts for our audience about what's happening in Israel and what we can do as college students here in America, as high schoolers, to talk to our friends about this?
Yeah, just remember that it doesn't stop with the Jews. Like it starts with the Jews. This type of jihadi style kind of rampaging and persecution. The literal slogan of the Houthis is death to Israel, death to America, you know, or what is it? Is death to Jews, death to Israel, death to America. Iran sees Israel as the little devil and the United States is the big devil. Their stated goal is to, you know, it's not just about the Jews. Like their stated goal is to obliterate the West. Israel is a little dot on the map. Israel is the reason why the entire region of the Middle East isn't a total like jihadi hellscape. It's the only reason. Like otherwise there would be no barrier. Like Israel is the West of the East. Israel is keeping at bay terrorists that would be so much more powerful if they had unrestrained access to the Middle East, to the Arabian Peninsula, and to North Africa. If Israel wasn't there, like, there would be no stopping. All of these nations would basically kind of agree on similar goals, and they would have nothing stopping them from going into Europe, you know, going into the United States. And so it's really important for people to understand, like,
Israel has the right to defend itself and actually has a duty to. And not to mention, we should be grateful to Israel for being able to go on the offense, take these people out. Because like what you said, if Israel is eradicated, then we're just the next step.
Right. And another thing that might be important for, you know, for conservative audience, there's this certain strain of conservatism that is very much anti-war, especially in the Middle East, and just like saying like, oh, we need to spend all of our money on American citizens. We need to stop giving money to Ukraine and Israel. And the truth is that, yeah, Ukraine is an unwinnable war. It's like, it's very much like how the United States and Russia decided to have a proxy war in Syria, and Assad is still in power. Neither of them won, but Syria is just a destroyed country with a bunch of jihadist factions now governing different towns and cities. And Assad is like still the figurehead with a lot less power. So you've gone from a secular dictatorship to a jihadi style splinter dictatorship. So in much a similar way, I think that, you know, Ukraine is an unwinnable war. It just doesn't make any sense to me how the United States didn't learn from what happened in Syria. But as far as Israel goes, there's actually a great imperative to help Israel out militarily. I mean, if the United States doesn't, Israel will find a way to do it, because, you know, the Jews don't want to be genocided again. But, you know, the United States, it's not as if the United States is just hemorrhaging money in Israel's direction and getting nothing back. The United States is getting a lot back. Not only do they have a very strong ally in the Middle East that is a democratic state in the war against Iran, because, of course, Iran has weaponized all of its proxies and started conflicts because Iran wants to be the regional hegemon. It doesn't, like, it's kind of Iran versus Saudi Arabia. Like, Saudi Arabia and Iran are like locked in this war. So that's Saudi insane. Arabia is now aligned it's aligned with the United States, and it was going to be aligned with Israel in a series of normalization agreements that is like an offshoot of Trump's Abraham Accords thing, his idea, because this was about to be finalized. And that's why, you know, the October 7th attacks occurred when they did, because they thought that, like, Israeli society was so fractured because they were having all these debates about, like, the judicial reform of Israel's high court. Hamas and, well, really Iran just deployed it to Hamas proxies and was like, the Israeli public, you know, is really in shambles right now. They're very divided. And so now is the best time to attack. And so because Iran wants to be the regional leader, and it wants to destroy the West. Not the people of Iran, certainly, but the Iranian regime. And so you have, like, American kind of allies in the Middle East that are allied for really no reason other than they don't want Iran to be the regional hegemon. When you think about it from that context, and when you think about it from the understanding that Israel is like a global startup, like, you know, Israel is like a technological pioneer as far, you know, surveillance, military technology, also just like computer chips. And because of the kind of pressure that Israel is under, it has become like a bastion of technological innovation. And the United States benefits from that. It benefits from the surveillance and the intelligence that Israel gives it. And fundamentally, all of the West, even countries that that want to sort of denigrate Israel continually within the media, they still benefit from the fact that a Jewish state exists to sort of oppose this type of radical jihadi ideology that, if given the chance, would have no qualms doing on October 7th, you know, what they did to the Israelis, to Germans, to the French, to the Americans, to the Canadians. They don't care. And Israel is trying to stave off this massive boulder of jihad surrounding it. It's trying to basically keep it at bay. If the West allows for this jihadi nonsense, this evil, dangerous ideology to just rampage through Israel, it's not going to stop there. And that's what I think is really, really, really important for like young Americans to understand, and just young Westerners in general.
Thank you so much for that. And thank you for taking your time to sit down and discuss this with us. We really, really appreciate your insights. I know I've learned a lot. And Maya, where can people find you?
So you can find me on YouTube at Maya Poet. You can find me on X at The Peace Poet 99. And I'm going to be starting a Substack soon. I talk about, you know, in my channel, I talk about the intersection of the issues of like this gender ideology, and also just, I talk about Middle East politics. Those are, yeah. I'm kind of a two-trick pony. So if you're interested in either of those, follow me. And I'm always happy to. I also host X Spaces, like Twitter Spaces.
Okay.
Point of my spaces is basically, I pick a different topic every time I do one. I invite people who I know have very, very different opinions from each other. Like, I don't want it to be an ideological echo chamber. I want people to engage in respectful, spirited, constructive disagreement. And so these spaces are very interesting. So if you're on X and you're interested in maybe debating or in listening,
yeah.
Right, like come into my spaces, follow me, and I'll gladly send you a mic in one of those spaces. And yeah,
thank you so much, Maya, and we will be linking all of that in the description of this episode. But thank you everybody so much for listening. Without further ado, we'll see you guys next time. And until then, let us firmly rely on the protection of divine providence. This is Self-Evident.